I couldn't even get a real guidebook on Kyrgyzstan. It was like a chapter in A Lonely Planet. You know, it didn't even get its own book. So I couldn't find out much about the country. The maps were almost non-existent. The last time the country was officially mapped was when the Soviets were in power. And that was 25 years previously. So the maps were way out of date and they were in Cyrillic text, which I could barely read.
Hey, it's George, and welcome to the Call to Adventure podcast. We're on a mission to help create happier people and a healthier planet, so let's get after it. Hello, hello. Welcome to another episode of the Call to Adventure podcast with me, the founder of Call to Adventure, George Beasley. I'm now back in Sweden after an awesome climbing holiday in the French Pyrenees, where I took some giant whippers and also designed some new fun trips for you guys for next summer. From speaking with listeners, I know lots of you are frustrated that you couldn't get away this year. So if you're keen to get something booked so that you've got an exciting trip to look forward to next year, you can already book on the Make Near Mountaineer course in February, if that floats your boat. Or if you're looking for a summer trip, join the mailing list to get booking priority and discounts on hiking, mountain biking, climbing, paragliding, canyoning, pretty much everything outdoorsy in the UK, Europe and further afield. And as with all our trips now, if it can't go ahead due to COVID, you'll have the option to move to a later date, move to a different trip, or get a full refund, no questions asked. So you can book on risk-free with full confidence. So if you're up for it, head over to Call to Adventure, that's T-O, calltoadventure.uk, and click on our adventures. But now on to today's pod. Today, we're speaking with adventurer Jenny Tuff, and yes, that is a real name. I'm sure Jenny gets that a lot. She's an endurance athlete and adventure traveler. Jenny's competed in ultra bikepacking races around the world, including the Atlas Mountain Race, Silk Road Mountain Race number one, the Transatlantic Way Race, and the Trans-Scotland, to name but a few. Jenny's also on a mission to run solo and unsupported across a mountain range on every continent. She's currently on 5 of 6, and some of which were world firsts, like her run across the Andes, which won't come as a surprise if any of you have visited the Andes, not somewhere you can imagine people running across, so keen to dig into that one. Jenny's also the editor of the book Tough Women, which we'll get into a little bit later. So Jenny, thanks for making the time for a chat.
Hey George, thanks for having me.
You're in Canada now, right?
Yeah, well, I just got back a week ago, so I'm actually in quarantine. But I'm looking out my window right now, and I am seeing the first dusting of snow on the mountains. It just came in the last few days, so I'm really looking forward to having winter out here.
Where have you just come back from?
Scotland, which is where I normally do live, and I've lived there for 9 years now.
So what was behind the move to Scotland?
It was never something that I actually planned. I mean, so my dad's Scottish, so I have dual citizenship, and I was, you know, raised to be Scottish, but hadn't spent any time out there. So it was always kind of in the back of my mind that one day I'd like to go to Scotland. And then I actually left Vancouver with my bicycle on a one-way ticket that I was going to go cycle around the Mediterranean and have this big adventure. But that was the year that the Arab Spring started. So I was actually entering the Middle East just when suddenly that wasn't somewhere that I could go. So I needed to get out of the Middle East for a little bit. And I think it was a 27 euro flight, Ryanair flight to Edinburgh, and cycled from the airport to my cousin's house and said, hey, I'm just going to stay here for a couple weeks while this whole Arab Spring protest thing goes away. Yeah. And then 9 years later, full-fledged Scottish citizen. Yeah.
We all shit on Ryanair, but yeah. 27 euro for a flight, and I paid £8 for mine to Sweden. I mean, it's so cheap, isn't it? Obviously, there's a whole kettle of fish that gets opened up with that, and it was all carbon offset and all that good jazz. So yeah, I don't necessarily, in Call to Adventure, aren't all about taking cheap flights all the time, but I live here now, so I feel like that was a good reason. So Scotland is one of those places where I don't think many people really explore it, even living in the UK. Like, I'm from England and I've lived there most of my life, but I've been up only a few times and always loved it. It kind of has that wild sense. It's much more like Scandinavia than the rest of England. So what was your experience like? Where do you recommend as your kind of top places for people to explore in Scotland?
The Highlands are this kind of romantic wilderness of the UK that, like you said, a lot of people don't actually end up making it to. There's something really magical about that landscape that I can't really describe, because objectively, a lot of it seems really horrible. The weather is almost always quite bad. It is quite remote and it takes a really long time to get there, especially if you're coming from England. I think that's why a lot of people realize they can actually get to the Alps quicker and just go that way. But it is just this fantastic place that just I'll always keep on discovering new trails. There's so many peaks to explore. And the Outer Hebrides would definitely be my, if you've got one trip to Scotland that you can do in your lifetime, get to the Outer Hebrides. You know, it takes some work to get there. And this is definitely something for post-COVID world. But and that's actually where my father grew up. So I've been back there a couple of times to explore. And it's just this insane place that is just so far removed from the rest of Britain.
I went last year on our Winter Skills and Summit Ben Nevis trip in the winter. And that was great. That was really, really cool. It was more adventurous than I expected, and got to see a little bit around Fort William, which is a very cool spot. I think it's like the home of adventure there, but yeah, the Outer Hebrides definitely on the list. It's interesting that you moved there, because I guess you have the family link, but it seems like the kind of outdoors and mountains, what we call mountains, are kind of very small mountains compared to what you have in Canada. So I guess it's just you grew up there, so it's something different. But are you from BC?
I grew up in the Canadian Rockies, actually. Well, I was born in Calgary, if you know it.
I read about your first cycling adventure when you cycled the Rocky Mountains, and that was actually my kind of first big cycling adventure too. We set off from Anchorage and then cycled over through the Canadian Rockies and then down towards the Great Divide mountain bike route. So we came through Calgary. We're actually going to Shambhala. I just remember going to Calgary. We met somebody in a Walmart car park, but that was a different story. So that was your first kind of big trip, right?
Yeah, I just finished university and didn't really know what I was going to do with my life, and there wasn't really a lot. I think we were kind of in a recession, so jobs were kind of definitely not like flying off the shelves. And I think I actually at the time said to myself, let's get one last thing in and then I'll go be an adult. But it totally didn't work out that way. Obviously, I just kind of got into the adventure thing and found a way to make it work around being an adult. So I had no idea what I was doing. It was absolutely jumping with 2 feet into the deep end kind of adventure. But yeah, I think that's the best way. I think when you're 21, that's exactly what you need to do, is just go scare yourself and do something hard and amazing.
And from there, you kind of gone from a pretty accessible adventure to now stuff where you're doing more kind of ultra racing and much more extreme stuff. So have you just done sequentially a little bit harder trips, or how did you go from cycle tour that's very accessible to running across continents, across Bolivia or Tian Shan? It's like, what's the transition been like? Has it just been pretty steady?
Yeah, I'm a big believer in you always have to push your comfort zone a little bit further. I believe your comfort zone is a fluid line. So every time you meet it, you inch it out a little bit further. And then that means that you're capable of more now. So if you just keep on pushing that line, and I was quite lucky that I started young. You know, growing up in the Canadian Rockies meant that by the time I was an adult, I did have a lot of backcountry skills and a lot of wilderness skills. And then I got into sport and running and stuff like that. So I had a lot of time to keep on inching this comfort zone out. So yeah, it was a gradual progression to make sure that, you know, you want to do things that do scare you, that are outside your comfort zone, but they can't be dangerously outside of your comfort zone. You need to have the skill level to back it up.
I talked a little bit about what it is, but can you just illuminate a little further? How did you come up with the idea, and what's the actual project involved?
It was never meant to be this way. I came across the Tian Shan, the central range of Kyrgyzstan. And do you ever have that moment where you see a picture of a place and like your heart stops and you go, my life isn't complete until I physically go there. I have to go see that place. And that was how I felt about the Tian Shan. They just looked like the most perfect mountains you can imagine. and nomads lived in them. And that really excited me because I think I might have the heart of a nomad. So I decided I just wanted to go to Kyrgyzstan and just explore these mountains. And I was going to take my bike. And then I thought, well, you know what? Kyrgyzstan's relatively small. If I take my bike, it'll be over too fast. So I should slow down and, you know, maybe I'll run. I love running. And I never thought before of using running as a form of transportation. You know, we hike and we cycle, but running just is seen as an exercise. And at the time, this wasn't really a sport. You know, now we call it fast packing, but that word wasn't really circling at the time. That was only 4 years ago. So I had to do quite a lot of research and quite a lot of preparation to figure out how to run unsupported, be able to carry everything I need for backcountry survival in Central Asia and get 1,000 kilometers across this country where there was no route. So I had to spend a lot of time also working on the navigation, like how on earth was I going to do it when there was no trail? So it was this huge project and that was just so exciting. And it was, you know, by far the hardest thing I'd ever done. And so I went out to Kyrgyzstan. And it took me, I think, 25 days to achieve that. And I just couldn't believe it. You know, it was probably the best I've ever felt about myself was probably running into the city of Osh and realizing that I'd completed this world first, that me, the plodding, curvy runner, had just done a 1,000 kilometer traverse kind of thing. Like it was so amazing. And I, after a little while of recovery, decided I really wanted to do it again. And I came up with a list of all the mountain ranges that would be cool to run across. And you don't realize there are so many more mountain ranges than we think there are on the world. And so I had this huge list because, of course, I love them all. So I just decided if I did one on every continent, then it's kind of a thing. And then I can justify it because I've like created a real thing, right? So a few months later, I went off to Morocco to do my African range. And yeah, the project just started. And it's been 4 years now and I still got one left. And it's been actually amazing.
There's lots of people doing great stuff in the outdoor and adventure scene, but this one really kind of captured my heart. I was just like, wow, that sounds amazing. I would love to do that. Apart from the fact that I'm not much of a runner, but I think a lot of people end up saying that they're not whatever the sport is and then just kind of get into it. So a bit like you were saying, you're thinking about taking your bike, but you wanted to do a bit more slowly. So I guess you mentioned a big part of it is the kind of planning and navigation. So what did that actually look like? So you think, yeah, I want to run across Kyrgyzstan. How do you actually plan that? What do the steps look like? Do you have to go and find, like, who's got maps of Tian Shan?
Oh, no one. So, I mean, normally I don't do a lot of research. Like, I'm quite notorious for maybe being too adventurous and that I like to just arrive with almost no knowledge and then just, like, jump. But because this was going to be so hard, I did actually want to do the research on this one. And that I spent quite a lot of time, you know, back then. I don't know if it's different now, but I mean, I couldn't even get a real guidebook on Kyrgyzstan. It was like a chapter in A Lonely Planet. You know, it didn't even get its own book. So I couldn't find out much about the country. The maps were almost non-existent. The last time the country was officially mapped was when the Soviets were in power. And that was 25 years previously. So the maps were way out of date and they were in Cyrillic text, which I could barely read. So there really wasn't much to go on. So I was really scraping the barrels of the internet, trying to find any information, anyone who had done any trips. So bike tours that had been across. Obviously, there's some 7,000ers. So there's some peak baggers that aren't really useful, but at least you can get like bits of information from them, reading any book that I could. So most of it at the end of the day was just looking at Google Earth, looking at satellite images and just saying, well, that probably would go. I mean, we'll find out. So I had to have a plan A, B, C, and then, you know, didn't even end up following any of those. I still ended up having to just rely on local knowledge as I went along and trying to get from place to place. So it was really exciting. I mean, it was getting to feel like a proper explorer, you know, like we think that's just in the golden age that's gone now to actually get to explore, to do something that's never been done, to do an actual expedition that the outcome is completely unknown, the way there is completely unknown. So that was, I mean, to me, that was just the most thrilling thing to get to do.
Yeah, I think a lot of us now look back to the heyday of adventure and exploration. And like you say, most things have been done. So it's really nice. Maybe that's part of what kind of captured me is that it really sounds from and kind of read like a real adventure, not being able to get that information. You kind of, it harkens back to a time when everything wasn't at the click of a mouse, and it wasn't all accessible. And I think the stands still hold that kind of appeal. What was it like day to day when you were cut? I don't think most people can imagine what it's like to run so far. So what did it look like?
The running is the easiest part. And I always find it really hilarious how many people are just really thrilled by the 1,000 kilometer thing. But I mean, anyone can run 1,000 kilometers. Maybe you won't like it, but like, the only things you need to know about that are right, left, and just keep going. So the running was always kind of the easy part, the relaxing part, and the part that I didn't have to worry about or think about. You know, as long as I ate close to enough food and drank enough water, I could keep that moving. But it was, you have to organize everything else. It was really important to me to go unsupported, because I think that's the most valid way to adventure and explore. So you're having to manage everything else. You're having to manage your navigation. You're having to manage a culture that is completely different from yours. You're having to keep yourself healthy, keep all your kit together, because you're like, I was in deep backcountry. You know, I didn't have a lot of wiggle room for error. Kyrgyzstan doesn't even have a mountain rescue. Like, there's no helicopter. So I can't have things go wrong. You don't have the option of not enjoying this or whatever. So day to day, I mean, it's kind of mundane. Like, I know it looks gnarly from the outside, but all you have to do is just keep moving in the same direction that you've been moving, find enough water, eat enough food, and then find a safe place to sleep at the end of the day. And that's your to-do list. It's the most freeing thing. It's so simple. And traveling ultralight, as you have to do to run, like really keeping your pack weight as minimal as possible, means you don't have things. You don't have any superfluous items in your life anymore. So it was this whole 25-day experience of just pure minimalism. And it's just living in nature and spending time with nomads and looking at beautiful mountains and just keeping my body moving over some of the most amazing trails I've ever found on this planet.
Yeah, I think the whole forcing yourself to be more minimal is a huge part of the appeal. And the fact that life is so simplified. I've never done ultra lightweight fast packing like that, but just from some bike packing routes where it's kind of like one pair of boxers jobby, and you bring the camera because, well, if you're into photography or film, then unfortunately, that means that you've got even less room for the rest of the stuff. So I always have that with me, and that takes up most of your room. And then there's not much space for anything else. But there's something so nice about it, like you say, that kind of simplicity of just having one goal. There's all the normal variables of the day are taken away, and it's just go for as long as you can and stay healthy along the way. And I think that that's part of the magic to it. But for the fast packing stuff, I mean, you've got to go even, it feels very lightweight. When I've done very lightweight bike packing in Guatemala or somewhere, I felt like I've basically had nothing, but possibly more than you had with your fast packing stuff. So how much are you carrying, and what kind of stuff do you have with you on a longer trip like that?
The biggest problem is that it's in mountains and I'm alone. So there are corners that absolutely cannot be cut. You know, so basically my pack would be my sleep system. And nowadays I would just do a hydrophobic down sleeping bag and a ultralight sleeping mat and then an emergency tarp. So my entire sleep system fills up like less than what my old sleeping bag probably would have filled up, like in the entire sleeping system and just a really small amount of space. And then you've obviously got your layers. So one t-shirt the whole way through, obviously. You're never going to get changed, but you have to be able to stay warm and dry. So good jackets. And then it's just food. So a stove and dehydrated food, and then your camera. The camera's the only thing that can't keep you alive, I guess. That's just there for, you know, most of us will not go without a camera.
Yeah.
But that's pretty much it. Nothing extra, nothing fancy.
What stove are you cooking on? Are you on like a super lightweight, minimalist one, or are you on?
Yeah, I've got one of those that's like the size of your thumb, just a tiny little thing. I think I got it from Alpkit actually. So it was maybe like 20 or 30 bucks, and it's used at altitude.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm pretty happy with that purchase.
And how about sleep systems? Like, what do you look for in that kind of stuff? Obviously, it's got to be ultra lightweight, but what are some other things that you're thinking about before you buy stuff like that?
What changed my entire world was that only 2 years ago, I found out that women's sleeping bags are actually a real thing. I always thought they were just a way to market something pink to me, but actually women's sleeping bags are smaller and snugger, and they put more down in the feet and hips. So, like, I didn't know that. I don't know why I didn't know that. So if you are a woman, or if you're under the size of 5'9", get yourself a woman's sleeping bag would be my biggest advice to anyone. And then, yeah, hydrophobic down. And because of that, I don't usually use the bivy outer. Like, I don't take anything extra. So I just sleep out in the sleeping bag because it's okay if it does get a little bit wet. And knowing that I'll sleep, when I do sleep really cold as it is, mountains can obviously suddenly get way colder than you thought they would. And then also take into account that if you're doing an endurance sport for that long, thermoregulation does start to become a problem and you'll be colder and colder as the thing goes on because your body will just stop functioning the way that it should. And so I do overdo it on the sleep system. So I'll bring a sleeping bag that's rated for much colder than I ever expect to be in.
And how about sleeping pad? Are you a thermarester?
No, I've done a few. So I've done, like when I did the Southern Alps, New Zealand, I was never that cold. So I did the one, I forget what it's called. It's one of those ones that's like half the size, half the length of your body. And then it's got all those holes in the middle. So it's literally just covering the absolute essentials. And it crunches up to smaller than the size of my fist. So it was pretty amazing. You're definitely not taking it for comfort. But then by contrast, the one before that was the Bolivian Andes, some of the tallest mountains in the world. You know, I was sleeping at over 4,000 meters several times. So I needed the proper insulated, much larger mat. You know, that run was the hardest because I did have to carry so much to stay alive at those temperatures. So that one I was insulated. I think it was a Sea to Summit. Yeah, something like that.
We've got the Comfort Plus Insulated. It's called something like that. And it's awesome. It's really, really good. It's probably, I imagine it's the same one. It's like rated super low and yeah, very, very comfortable. Bolivia is one that really kind of caught my eye. The thought of running that, I've done a little bit here and there, traveling around Bolivia and a few mountains. And the thought of running across there was definitely surprised me. So how was that whole experience? I mean, you mentioned that it was probably the toughest one.
Yeah. And now that I'm five deep into this whole journey, I'm still saying that Bolivia was the hardest. But a lot of that was real. And then a lot of that was also in my head. It really surprised me when I started that one that I was absolutely terrified. I was literally paralyzed with fear. The morning that I was meant to start, you know, I woke up really early. I was going to get a good start because I had, as I did almost every day of that expedition, I had several massive mountain passes to get over. So I thought I'll get an early start. And I remember getting up and there was really bad weather. And, you know, I was meant to be there in the dry season, but when I got to Bolivia, it turned out that because of climate change, the dry season hadn't really happened. And it was terrible weather forecasted the whole way through. You know, there was no chance in changing the dates because it was like weeks worth of bad weather. So I got up and the weather was terrible. And I remember just lying there in this kind of hut that I'd rented out in this tiny town and just thinking, I can't do this. I don't want to do this. This is way too hard. I'm absolutely terrified. And wasted an hour just sitting there staring out the window, just going, oh God, I can't. And almost every day was like that. It just, normally when I feel afraid like that, I just have to push myself and start going. And then you realize you're being silly and you get over it. But I didn't. I think every single day I was just, you know, there was just so much going on and so much that could go wrong. You know, there was the physical environment, being at that altitude is obviously just difficult. Running at 5,000 meters, you know, I never really got around to the altitude on that. It was always really hard on my body. The navigation was really hard. As you said, like the terrain out there, those Andes, they're brutal. So you're up against some really difficult terrain. And again, like the weather, like I said, the weather was a catastrophe. I had thunderstorms multiple times every single day. So I was always cold and wet. And then outside of the environment, there was also very much a human factor. I was being, you know, Bolivia does have one of the worst crime rates in the world against women, and attitudes towards gringas definitely wasn't any better. And I was constantly being told that I was going to be murdered. And, you know, if you travel a lot, you'll get used to hearing that kind of stuff. You'll get used to being told that everywhere is dangerous and you should have just stayed home kind of thing. And I'm really good at ignoring it, but it really seeped in this time. And I think because I knew that it wasn't entirely unfounded, that people were warning me against violence in the regions that I was going through. So I did have a lot to be afraid of. And I really felt it on that one. And it was a real struggle every single morning to get myself out of my bivy and try and go up yet another over 4,000 meter mountain pass.
there's this strange phenomenon when traveling through Central America, and the murderers are always in the next village, and they just say, "Don't, no, don't sleep there. They're all crazy and alcoholics and murderers." And then the next day, you end up having to stay there, and then it just kind of passes on and loops onto the next village. And but there is something to be said for it. I mean, like, the statistics speak for themselves, and some parts of Mexico. So you certainly got to still keep your wits about you, and it's definitely not that it's not dangerous. It's just that it's like you say, you probably wouldn't go anywhere if you listened to all of the locals all the time.
Exactly.
But I mean, that to run through that environment is pretty amazing. So if you, and doing it for so long, I can imagine that it would just wear you down mentally. It's not that difficult to be tough, kind of mentally tough for a short period of time. But when you're doing something that's very physically demanding, but also up against that kind of mental stuff as well, and then the worries about safety and weather, how did you keep going, or what was it that kept you going when everything was kind of so tough and against you?
You know, the one thing I can always fall back on if all of my reserves fail is that you can't quit here. Like, you're in the middle of the backcountry, you've got to get home somehow, so you can't just, you know, throw your toys out and say you're done. So I at least had that I did need to get to the finish line, because, you know, I needed a way to get back home. I don't know. I mean, there were a lot of times that I thought that expedition would fail. I think partway through, I actually looked at it. I looked at my route and looked at the flight back that I had booked, and knowing that I needed to make that flight, I didn't have the option to change it. I realized that it actually couldn't be done. And so I think I went through a few days where I knew it was going to be a failure. So I decided, you know, I'll just go down swinging. I'll just try and get as far as I can get, knowing that I'm not going to make it. And then I think having that mindset and that I'm just going to go down swinging kind of thing, I somehow did pick up the mileage and somehow made it back. But I mean, it was by the skin of my teeth that I finished that expedition on time. Like, it was really run to the airport with all my gear still wet and disgusting and have to deal with it on the other side when I landed in Edinburgh. Which wasn't nice.
The people sitting next to you must have been like, "Who is this lady?"
I thought they were going to have to evacuate the plane, because I just put my shoes and my luggage and put it in the hold. And I thought, oh, that's like, as those start to dry.
<it's> Poor baggage handlers.
Yeah, exactly. I know. Yeah. I don't always know what keeps me going. I guess, to be fair, keeping going is the easiest thing. You know, you've made all these plans and spent all this time working out how an expedition is going to go, and that's all that you planned. If you get to the point where you decide that you don't want to do it anymore, now you have to make a new plan. You have to figure out, how are you going to get out of here? How are you going to get home? What are you going to do about it? So actually, when you're at the point that you're really starting to wear down, and knowing that every day on something this challenging, you're going to burn several more of your matches, and you're going to have less the next day and less the next day after that, and so on. So every day you're physically less, but you're also mentally just exhausted, and making decisions gets harder. And that's something you have to be really conscious of when you're going alone. So making the decision to quit, which is something that you didn't plan for, you never made a plan for that, that's actually cognitively too, like, overload. You know, you'd have to really be able to sit down and work out a new plan. And so it is just easier to keep going. And so sometimes, you know, there have definitely been days that weren't nice, or I shouldn't have done them in the first place, but it was just like, all I knew was to keep moving forward. And so you just keep on soldiering. And as you get worn down, it goes both ways. You know, a big adventure always has its peaks and troughs, your emotional ups and downs. And I think the further you go and the more exhausted you get, those peaks and troughs become deeper and higher. You know, your highs become really high and your lows become a little bit scary, but then another high is going to come along.
Mm. How about your journey into bikepacking and ultra bikepacking races?
Something that surprised me that I got into racing, because it's not really my personality to compete against other people. I mean, I certainly compete against myself, and I compete against myself really hard, but being in an organized race just didn't seem like my thing. But I really love this marriage of pushing yourself physically while also doing adventure in a place that you've never been. So when I discovered bikepacking ultra races, I was really intimidated at first, because cyclists just really intimidate me. But I got there and discovered this tribe of people that were weird the same way I was weird. You know, people that were pushing the sport and pursuing it for the same reasons I was. And then suddenly I was just surrounded by people for the first time who like really did the same stuff as me. So for me, it's not so much about the competition. I mean, I think it's really cool when we all get together and pit ourselves against really hard challenges. But for me, the best part is just spending time with those people. So like, I'm the worst competitor in the world. You know, I'm the type of person that is the reason why medals for participation exist in sports. Because I'm like, it's just so awesome that we're all here and we're all winners for showing up and all that.
Well, you certainly like to test yourself, though. I mean, you were the first female finisher in the Atlas Mountain Race and the Silk Road Mountain Race, right?
Yeah, good times.
I think for people that know about ultra bike packing races, they probably have a good appreciation of just how hard they are. But can you just let's just take one of them, and then can you just kind of take us through what the race involves because the distances are horrendous. And we were lucky enough to meet Lael Wilcox when we just dropped into Anchorage and when we were starting our bike tour. And she kind of set us up and opened us up to the world of these incredible ultra bike packing races. But yeah, the thought of the distances that people are doing on their bikes is just unfathomable. So yeah, take us through one of those and how the kind of a bit about the race.
I'll do the Atlas because that was this year, which is hard to imagine this adventure that I had in the year 2020. So you know, the most important rules to know about this style of racing is, one, it's single stage, so the clock never stops, and the races tend to be more than a week long, so you win if you can sleep the least. So, you know, the single stage factor, it never stops, and that's why the distances people do in a day get so high, is because people are doing all day, every day. And the other most important rule is that it's unsupported. So you can't accept help from anyone else, including the other competitors, and you have to carry everything that you need. So that, to me, there's a lot of integrity in this style of racing, which is really cool. So the Atlas race, yeah, that was February 2020, and it was, I'm going to get all the numbers wrong, I think it was 1,300 kilometers long off-road, and we had 7 or 8 days to do it. And it was pretty cool. I mean, I was, again, really intimidated, despite the fact that, you know, I'd done these races before and I'd done the Atlas before. I think I still started the race close to the very back of the pack. There was about 200 of us that left Marrakesh, and I just looked at them all and thought, oh gosh, they're all real mountain bikers and I am not a real mountain biker, so I'll just hang back and let them go. And I always do that to myself. I always build it up in my mind before the gun goes off, and then it does and we start pedaling. And I remember, oh yeah, I love riding my bike and I know how to do it again. And so I just went for it. I just kind of had a goal to keep my shit together. I never set out to win because I didn't think I had any shot at winning, which is probably what helped me the most, was that I just had a goal to just keep moving and not have any catastrophes and just stay healthy and keep the bike in working order and just do as well as I physically could. And so that was what I did every day, was just kind of kept myself to a schedule. And it was a really social race, which was really cool. I was almost always riding with other guys. And that was like the best part of it, was the experiences I had riding with other people from all around the world in this incredible landscape.
It's quite unusual to have an event like that where the competitors kind of talk to each other, or almost like get on. They're kind of like not competing. And in climbing, it's the same as well. Like before, people are doing problems in bouldering in the Olympics, for example, or when it comes to the Olympics, they talk to each other and give each other their kind of shared beta. And there's something about bike packing as well that shares the same spirit. In some way, everybody's obviously competing against each other, but from everything that I've seen and all the races that I've followed, it seems like there's a really good community, which is cool. But still, the thought of getting into ultra racing like that, I think, seems pretty inaccessible for a lot of people. So if somebody likes the idea of it, though, what advice would you give for somebody to build up to one of the less extreme, but still like a bike packing race?
I would say just start with the experience in itself. So go for a really long ride that's going to take you 2 days to do it. You know, take your bivy kit, put it in your saddle pack, or strap it to your bike somehow, and just go out and see how far you can go and sleep out in a really dirt baggy kind of way, which is what we do. You know, we sleep in like the bushes next to the trail. I just like, whatever you can do, that's going to be the fastest way. And you're only going to sleep for a few hours and then keep going. So if you're interested in this world, and you absolutely should be because it's the best, then I would just say, you know, start. I mean, I always think if you have a goal in mind, say you want to do the Silk Road race or something like that, make a list of the reasons why you don't think you can do it today. So is it that you don't have the right kit? Is it that you don't have the skills? You don't know if you can ride a bike that far, whatever it is, you know, make that list. And then for every item on that list that is the barrier to you doing that goal, find a way to check it off. So if it is just the skills, then work on that. Grab some friends and go bikepacking. There are smaller races, or not even races, but just events, particularly in the UK. We have a big scene that's really coming out now. So, you know, spend some time Googling bikepacking events and races and set yourself up for some smaller ones close to home, you know, and just start ticking away at what you need to have in order to be at the start line of one of these races soon. And, you know, it is achievable, actually. I mean, when I started, it did seem extremely unachievable. I'd never cycled anywhere near those distances in a single day. But then the first time I did a 200 kilometer day, I was like, oh, yeah, I can do a 200 kilometer day. It's just a different pace. And the first time I did a 400 kilometer, it was the same. I just thought, you know, anyone can do this. Obviously, it takes work. It might take years, but anyone can get there. Like they say, it's just like riding a bike.
Jesus, 400 kilometers in a day, though, that still sounds insane. I've ridden my bike a lot.
It's a long day.
That is incredible. But yeah, I guess, like you say, everybody probably feels that. It still feels, after, I don't know how far we rode on our bike trip, something like 14,000 kilometers or whatever, probably some more. But the thought of what 400 in a day is pretty amazing. I mean, I think we only did probably, the biggest day was, I don't know, 110 miles or something. And that's with some road as well, like on the road, but with all of our stuff on the bike too. But yeah, I do like the idea of it. There's something that kind of piques my curiosity, which I guess is what a lot of people get from this kind of stuff, like wanting to know how far you could go. So yeah, I'm going to have to find a bikepacking event and start training for it. Definitely feeling inspired. Let's talk about Tough Women. You edited the book, and what's the story there? How did that come about?
You know, when I did that first adventure I talked about when I was 21 years old and I set off to cycle to the Yukon, almost everyone I met kind of reacted the same way. They were like, oh my gosh, you really going to go alone? Shouldn't you have kind of a boyfriend or someone? And at the time, that didn't really bother me because I was 21. I was completely green and their doubts were completely valid. And I always had this fantasy that one day when I grew up, and I'd proven myself, no one would speak to me that way anymore. And, you know, I realized a couple of years ago when I hit my 30s, and I have objectively proven myself. You know, I've done several world first expeditions. I've won adventure races. You know, on paper, you know, I'm decent. I've proven myself and I'm grown up. And yet I still get the same reaction almost everywhere that I go. I mean, even going out for a run in the Highlands, I might meet someone who will speak to me that way and doubt me. And be shocked that I can do anything by myself. And that made me realize that the way that we perceive women in sport is still wrong. And at the same time, I realized I now have a platform that I can do something about that. And so I always get asked in my work life, I always get asked, why aren't there more women in the outdoor industry? And it always baffles me because actually I work with women all the time. The outdoor industry is full of women. I would say it's almost 50-50. But when we get to the highest level, you know, I'd blame TV more than anyone else, but at the highest level of media, we tend to see one type of adventurer and one narrative. And that's not really the way that the outdoors are to me and the type of people that go into the outdoors. So I wanted to give a platform to women who are full-time employed in the outdoor industry, women who are pushing the boundaries and doing lots of different things. I give them a platform and then also have an answer to this question and to prove to people that women are tough and there are different ways to be tough. So that was kind of how the book came about. And I got all these incredible writers from all around the world and all different types of sports and ages and diverse backgrounds. And yeah, it was definitely my favorite thing that I've achieved lately was to see that book come out and see people, women, girls, boys, and men start to pick it up.
What did you learn about toughness from it?
That it has so many different faces. So, I mean, obviously that word being my name is a word that I thought about my whole life. You know, when I was a little girl at school, I got teased for it all the time. And I actually hated my name. I was so embarrassed because like it was ridiculous that a girl should be called tough. You know, so I was always like hilarious to the kids in my class that that was my name because it just didn't suit, right? Mm. And it took me a long time to come around to it and go, hang on, that's a freaking awesome name. Like, I love that that's my name. Obviously, I still always get teased about it. And I'll always challenge anyone if they can come up with an original tough joke that would make my day. But, you know, I tend to hear the same ones almost every day. And I love them because, again, I love my name. But I've always thought about that word quite a lot. And why was it funny that a little girl had that as a name? And what are our perceptions of what that word is? And I do think it's a very diverse word that can be defined in so many different ways. And I think all women are tough. And that doesn't mean maybe what it is represented in the media. And there are just so many different ways to express your toughness and so many different ways to find your toughness. And I think everyone has it. I absolutely wouldn't hear it from anyone if they told me that they weren't tough. Everyone's got their particular unique toughness.
So do you think about training, resilience and toughness per se, or do you just kind of do these things that you like and then you end up becoming hardened from spending lots of time in the outdoors and just kind of doing things that you like, you just happen to like them and then they end up making you very resilient? Or do you think more structured about it, like I need to do this or have a mental practice or a physical practice to toughen you?
No, I definitely am kind of the free-for-all adventurer that I never have structured training for anything, whether it's mental or physical. But that is valid, that you build it up. The more times that you put yourself in stressful situations, the better you get at handling stressful situations. And so it's definitely, I think I realized a little while ago and someone had asked me something similar, and I just kind of realized, you know, the best thing about how many ridiculous things that I put myself through by now is that I can almost always truthfully say I've been through worse. So when I do get greeted with a really stressful situation or something that's really scary or something I didn't plan for, I can almost always go back in my mind to a time that was worse than this. And that's quite freeing. That makes things a lot easier. You can calm yourself down. You can say, right, well, I've been through worse and I got through that, so I can get through this too. And that's, you know, there's just no replacement for experience in those situations.
Kind of dials down the intensity on most stuff because you harken back and think to when things shit really hit the fan and you kind of got out of that. So yeah, it's definitely good to be able to pull on that deep well of when things went pear-shaped. What's some of the worst advice or bad advice that you hear kind of related to the outdoors or adventure?
It's hard to say it in a diplomatic way. Obviously, everyone needs to stay safe and stay within the realm of their comfort zone so that they are safe. But I love doing solo challenges. It's not that I'm antisocial. It's just that, you know, I started doing them when I was a young woman, and definitely I'd never been in too many situations where I was in complete control of everything. And doing a solo challenge is putting yourself in the driver's seat and making big decisions all by yourself and being completely responsible for yourself and having to fix all your problems. So I think they're great, but you know, to this day, I get discouraged from them all the time, always being told that you can't, like literally that word, that C word, you can't go there alone. You won't make it alone. You absolutely need a partner or a group, or you should wait and go on a guided tour or something like that. So I hate hearing people being discouraged from doing things like that. And you still hear it all the time. And I just think, like, I've got my grit and I can do it alone. So that's probably the one that is really standing out to me that I just keep on hearing repeatedly is discouragement from people, especially women, doing things alone.
Yeah, it seems to be a great fuel for the fire for lots of people. You can use it. It can be taken in a way that discourages you or in a way that kind of really makes you so much more determined to do something. I think that's definitely the much more powerful way to frame it. So, yeah, you obviously have done some great adventures around the world and done lots of traveling. And as another kind of travel and adventure enthusiast, I've been lucky enough to do some traveling too. But now we have to think about our kind of impact on the environment. How do you think about your carbon footprint in relation to these travels?
It's something I think about a lot, and I do get twisted up in my mind about what is worthwhile and what can't be justified. Like, I always offset my flights, and then I always just wonder, have I just bought myself feel-good tokens? Like, I don't know. But, you know, you got to use the technology that's available, and that's one of them. I'm a really big believer in assessing every trip and saying, is this worthwhile? Can I justify this? So what am I going to do for that place while I'm there to justify the fact that I went there? So, you know, a lot of us who are into adventure, we're almost automatically really good tourists because we're traveling in a very low carbon or no carbon way once we arrive, staying in these small villages, contributing to the microeconomies within a place. And that's really important and that's really valid. And sharing the stories of these places, you know, people won't protect it unless they love it. So when you do travel, and if you're a travel writer and you're sharing all these places and creating stories that help people connect with places around the world, places and people and environments, that does cultivate this love for the planet that we're on, which is the most essential thing to contributing to change. So yeah, I think it's a complicated issue, and it is something that I'm always going to be challenging myself on and wondering if I can keep on justifying this or going on trips that are completely worthwhile. It's the issue that we all need to figure out how to do it. We need to figure it out fast.
It is just a hard question. I don't think there is an easy answer. And yeah, I think I'm very much in the same boat as you. I spend a lot of time thinking about it. And I'm encouraging more people to go abroad and take flights. I mean, a lot of the adventures are in the UK as well. But ultimately, there are all of those real tangible benefits of spending money in local economies. And like you say, adventurers tend to be better tourists, taking care of places and going to more remote regions and speaking to some of the guides in Nepal and people out there. Like, they are really, really hurting now with COVID, and just so much of their livelihoods and their families' well-being relies on tourist money. That's just the way that it is. But it's certainly not a free pass where carbon offsetting is great, and we do it, and I think it's certainly better than not doing it. But it's not that get out of jail free card, and so yeah, I think encouraging people to explore the backyard is really good. Take fewer flights and really ask yourself, is there anywhere else that I can do this? One of our environmental writer Jacob wrote a really good article on this called "Carbon Offsetting: Scam or Salvation." And he had a good hierarchy in there where it's like, can I do something similar at home? If not, can I drive or go by boat or go low carbon? If not, then take a flight and carbon offset it and try not to take too many. And I think that's a good way to think about it. But it's certainly a tricky one that's not that easy, and I think getting harder and harder as time goes by.
But yeah, as long as we keep on asking ourselves those questions, I think that's the important part, that we're not sticking our hand in the sand. We're all asking each other and talking about it openly. And yeah.
So what have you got your eye on for the future? Have you got any projects? You've still got your last big run across continent, but have you got any other plans? Anything else in the woodwork?
So the most important thing for me is finishing this project. I'm a really good starter and a really terrible finisher. So I'm quite conscious of the fact that if I decide what is next right now, I'll get too excited about that and forget to finish what I've started. So I am just keeping my focus on finishing this project with one mountain run left to go. And I think, I don't know if I'm ready to say this out. Oh, if I say this out loud, I guess I'm doing it. Crossing a mountain range from start to finish is probably the best thing I've ever landed on. It just suits me so well. It makes me so happy. And I started getting sad thinking that it would end, that I would finish this. So I thought I might just go back and do a different set of ranges by bicycle. And that's kind of what's percolating in my brain right now. If COVID could just like sort itself out and go away and let us be free again.
That would be ideal. I mean, not a great time for adventure travel. If we could just get some kind of vaccine and explode that over the world, that would be ideal.
Yeah, glad we sorted that out.
Well, yeah, Jenny, it's been great to chat. Thank you so much for taking the time. And if people want to pick up a copy of Tough Women, where can they get that?
All major book retailers and also the major online retailer that everyone hates called Amazon. And if you go there, please, please, please leave us a review so that more people will buy the book. Thanks.
And if people want to find out a little bit more about you and your journeys, where's the best place for them to check out?
I'm trying to be active on social media, Jenny Tough, and that's also my website, jennytough.com.
Awesome. Well, thanks again, Jenny. It's been really, really good to chat.
Thanks, George. Bye.
Thanks, everybody, for listening. Until next time. Bye-bye. So that's it for this episode. I hope you enjoyed it. Head over to Call to Adventure. That's T-O, calltoadventure.uk for show notes and more about this episode. You'll also find lots of other free content there. Things like how-to guides and gear reviews, everything to get you out on your next adventure. We've also got loads of adventures for you to join us on in the UK and abroad. We've got things like climbing, hiking, mountaineering, surfing, wild swimming, ski touring, and we're adding new ones all the time, so do take a peek. Each booking helps us fund our green mission, and all international trips are carbon offset. Please do rate and review the show if you're enjoying it. It helps get more people engaged with the outdoors and on board with protecting wild places. Thanks for listening. See you next time.